In retrospect, it might have been driven by a kind of midlife intellectual crisis. The sort of midlife crisis for which a convertible sports car is not necessarily an effective answer, which is not to say that I don't still dream about one. It was about 20 years ago, chapel service at Heston College. The title of the message was, "This I Believe." The thesis was, the older I get, the more deeply I believe in some things, but the more I question some other beliefs that I've held tightly for many years. The experiences of our lives have a tendency to complicate things. Easy answers, formulaic responses and cliches, yes or no responses, all of those seem inadequate in the face of complex realities. As a professing follower of Jesus, I said that I have become more deeply committed to nonviolence and peacemaking. Perhaps that's easier to contemplate laying down one's life in older adulthood than as a 20-year-old whose life presumably still stretches far into the future. The idea of following Jesus is best lived in the context of a community of faith, and that holds more weight than it might have for me earlier. Walking through the joys and the challenges of parenting makes one keenly aware of the need for others to mentor our children and grandchildren in the faith. This I believe more deeply than ever. Our long-held commitment to the kingdom of God that supersedes allegiance to any earthly political entity means far more to me now than it did when I was baptized at the age of 16. On the other hand, life happens. Untimely deaths underscore that God doesn't always provide physical healing in ways that we might have expected. We rightly pray for protection for our loved ones, but bad things still occur. On the Saturday of Easter weekend, I attended the memorial service for M.J. Sharp in Kansas. How do you make sense of the senseless? And last Sunday, I cried as I read reflections from his father, John, written on the first Father's Day since MJ's brutal murder. And members of this congregation have gone through similar agonizing experiences, some of them very recent. Some things I believe more deeply, other things I hold much more lightly. The response to that chapel address at Heston College, which was spoken from the very spot where MJ's service was held, was unexpected, surprising in two ways. First, that the students, at least some of them, were actually listening. Apparently, they were curious to know what a college administrator actually believes. Or I can well imagine some of them wondered if college administrators believe anything. But the second reaction was more unexpected. Schedule was such that we would go from chapel service straight to the cafeteria, and almost the whole campus went to the cafeteria after chapel. And within a few hours, an email came to me from a few students with a list of questions. And over the following number of days, we had a number of in-depth theological conversations. And at the heart of their discomfort was the fundamental assumption that maturing in faith is synonymous with depth of conviction about one's beliefs. From their perspective, certainty is positively correlated with faith development. And in their minds, now, they were mostly first and second year college students, 18 to 20 year olds. In their minds, as it spun out over the next couple of days, a 40-something adult who has been declared a follower of Jesus for more than two decades should, by definition, have figured it all out. For a mature adult to confess that there are more questions about some aspects of faith rather than fewer was unsettling. Fortunately, at least for some of the students, there was an interest in continuing the conversation, and a few days later, a group came to our house for several hours of discussion about these and other questions. Fast forward to a little more than a year ago. About 3 years after Greg Boyd's book, Benefit of the Doubt, was published, my then 93-year-old father was failing physically. The full title of Boyd's book is Benefit of the Doubt, Breaking the Idolatry of Certainty. And I knew that my dad, through a pastor friend of mine, I knew that my dad was wrestling with questions of certainty. Surely not uncommon when having huge amounts of time to anticipate death. He had been declining physically for 3 or 4 years. His mind was very sharp until the last week. So he had plenty of time to think about, contemplate death, and think back over his life. But as he approached certain death, he had a lot of questions. Boyd challenges the idea that a person's faith is as strong as it is certain. He invites us to embrace a faith that does not strive for certainty, but rather for commitment in the face and in the midst of uncertainty, for trust. Boyd dares to suggest that the mindset in which our top priority is to be certain is misguided, self-indulgent, idolatrous, and even dangerous. But as he puts it, I completely understand why a multitude of believers try to cling to it. It feels good. Another theologian, Peter Entz, now on faculty at Eastern University, takes a slightly different tack in his book, The Sin of Certainty, Why God Desires Our Trust More Than Our Correct, quotes in his title, beliefs. And he points to the biblical story for many examples of patriarchs and matriarchs of the faith who finally had to rely on trust in God rather than beliefs. And Enns goes on to remind us of Job's story, with which most of us are familiar. And he exegetes a familiar text in Proverbs, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not rely on your own insight. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make straight your paths. And as Enns put it, the heart is the center of the will, and it's a decision to place trust in God even in the face of human limitations on knowledge and understandings. And our scriptures are full of this most human dilemma. Created in God's image, it's no surprise that you and I are gifted with the capacity and the desire to know, to seek truth, to understand, to explain, to be curious. And as far as we know, this insatiable desire to know is one attribute that separates us from the rest of the animal kingdom. So most of us have dealt with children and grandchildren who ask that infamous question unendlessly, why? 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 And it goes through all of life. We ask that question, why? And we see the examples in the scriptures from the Old Testament Job and his friends to the New Testament story of the man at the pool of Siloam. The persistent question is, why? Why is the sky blue? But why? Why did Job suffer? Who sinned, this man or his parents? Why is he lame? And that drive to know has generally yielded positive outcomes. It's, for the most part, a pretty exciting time to be human. On any given day, one can read about new discoveries in our universe, amazed by the vastness of the cosmos, stunned by the growing awareness of what a tiny speck this Earth is as compared to the galaxies. Someone told me just this week that the Astrophysics Observatory at Harvard University employs 900 people. My immediate question was, well, no wonder they're finding a new galaxy every week. You got 900 people staring out into space, they got to find something. or to go in another direction on the very same day, from looking at the cosmos to looking deeply inside the cells and the molecular structures. Most of us carry in our pockets, in the form of a smartphone, a little device that has more computer power than Apollo 11 did to put people on the moon. That's pretty amazing. When we moved to Eastern Pennsylvania a decade after that moon walk, I had a conversation with a member of our congregation about that landing, and she insisted. She absolutely knew that was simply a program on TV. She was really Pennsylvania Dutch, so it was actually Tee-wee, but I got it. When Neil Armstrong came to Harrisonburg to speak at a prayer breakfast just a couple of years ago, I happened to be sitting at the table with him. I told him that story. He just chuckled. He said, "I was there." But we all benefit in amazing ways from this human drive to know. This is where, for me, this deep distrust of science in segments of our culture makes little sense. There's evidence all around us of scientific agnosticism, and yet most everyone seeks medical attention when needed. Put that in your mind for a little bit. So it's perfectly logical, it seems to me, to seek knowledge and certainty in one's spiritual journey. And therein lies a most vexing conundrum. At the very core of our human being is the deep desire to know, to be certain, but we are simultaneously stymied by the limitations of our humanness. And ultimately, if one is intellectually honest, we're confronted by the boundaries of human capacity to know fully, fully, without a shadow of doubt. Boyd puts it this way: "As people of faith, you and I should always be willing to accept our human limitations and to say, 'This I believe about such and so, but I may be wrong.' To assert there's no possibility that one can be wrong is to have crossed the line from humanness to deity." That's my paraphrase of what Boyd is saying. We've crossed the line from being human to attempting to be God when I say, "I now have complete certainty about any particular belief, and there is no possibility that I could be wrong." And then he offers yet another caveat to the search for truth. If I'm in a search for truth, which is a very human endeavor, and I say I have found the truth, I am by definition no longer in a search for truth because I found it. Call off the search. What a wonderful achievement. The greater my certainty, the greater my faith maturity, and all will be well. Except it never quite works out that way in real life. Unless one chooses to live in a bubble that does not allow for any questions that might challenge that certainty. My dad wouldn't have used all those same words, but that debate was going on in his mind. As his body slowly deteriorated and he wanted to die, he was very clear about his profession of faith in Jesus. He knew what he believed about many things. His life was a testimony to his faith. As a young man, he served his country through civilian public service. He was right off the farm and got put on a troop train from Iowa City to Terry, Montana, in the middle of the night. Everyone else on the train was in uniform. All the seats were filled, and he had to sit on a suitcase on this troop train going to CPS. And when they got to Terry, Montana, in the middle of the night, at 2 o'clock in the morning, the conductor said, "We're not going to stop. We're just going to slow down. And when I say jump, you jump, and I'll throw your suitcase after you." And that's what happened. After returning from CPS, he became a partner in a farm implement business, and he expressed his values. I saw them on a daily basis, his values that were rooted in his understanding of discipleship. But in the end, like all of us will someday face, he had to confront the reality that his certainties were different from some of his friends and neighbors. And that begged the question, who's right? A question that none of us can fully answer within the confines of our humanness. So in both of the Old Testament texts for today, from Jeremiah and from Psalms, we see the prophet and the psalmist wrestling with those who would wish them harm and ill will. They've responded to such threats within the norms of human tendencies. Why me? Where are you? Have I not proven my faithfulness? And it's not a stretch for any of us to appreciate the questions that Jeremiah and Job and the psalmist would be asking in the face of those real life experiences and individuals. If you haven't asked those questions, if I haven't asked those questions, one could logically assume one of several possibilities. We haven't lived very long, or we aren't yet willing to be intellectually honest about our circumstances. So let me suggest that the invitation to trust God is also most meaningful in a context much larger than any of us as individuals. We live in an era where the foundations of our culture and society seem shaky. We find ourselves stepping carefully over what seems to be uneven ground. And I draw your attention back to the bulletin, the cover of the bulletin, and the photo, very apt photo, by Miriam, one of our junior MYFers, a photo of her brother Adam's feet, which I note are not very clean on that photo. That photo won a prize in a national competition and was displayed in the residence of former Vice President Biden. Notice how carefully Adam appears to be navigating his way across this ladder. He's placing his feet very carefully. And I'd suggest that most of us find ourselves in such a place metaphorically. Not exactly like we're walking on even, solid terrain these days. We take a step at a time, sometimes testing, sometimes tentative, sometimes hesitant, and we're not totally sure that we can trust that which is beneath us. And things and institutions that we must often had thought were trustworthy not so long ago are now subject to question and reinterpretation. Institutions that were viewed positively are frequently cast in a negative light. The erosion of trust is deep. And it almost certainly is the case that we are experiencing extreme swings of the pendulum. We ought to remind ourselves that perceptions of trustworthiness are dramatically shaped by our own socioeconomic place in society, shaped by gender, shaped by race. And if I can be so bold as to say that the current political slogan, "Make America Great Again," carries very different meaning for some than for others. And for some, it's absolutely meaningless, even frightening. So our current life situation begs the question, in whom do we trust? It's a question relevant to each of us as individuals and to us as a collective body, as a church. It's perhaps one of the most foundational questions any of us will ever ask. And the answer is both simple and profound. After all, it's imprinted on our pennies and nickels and dimes and quarters. In God we trust. It's that simple. I enjoy irony. That has to rank as a great irony. On the one hand, we could suggest that every day we have the opportunity to reach into our pockets, to remind ourselves that our trust lies in God. And of course, at my age, unless I have my bifocals on and look at the phrase, I'll miss it. But for citizens of a nation that spends more on military budgets than the next 13 countries combined, to brazenly point out or to print on our currency that we trust in God is perhaps the definition of irony or chutzpah. Let me suggest that just like Job and Jeremiah and Jesus, in God we trust should be printed on our lives, but with several amendments for clarification. It's not an excuse to dodge responsibility. That could be what one means when I say I trust in God. A couple of years ago, I was meeting with the board of directors of the Evangelical Environmental Network. It's an educational and lobbying group that pays attention to climate change and is attempting to educate and lobby legislators on behalf of responses to climate change. And we were eating dinner together, I think it was in Charlotte, North Carolina, somewhere south here. We were eating together one evening before our board meeting, and a server asked us who we were and why we were meeting, and our president, Mitch Hescox, who's spoken here, briefly explained our mission, just as I have now done, and he explained it, and then her immediate response was something like, well, first off, I'm not sure climate change is happening, and secondly, she said, even if it is happening, I trust God to take care of it. Now, I kept my mouth shut, which I know for some people is hard to imagine, but I did. But I wanted to ask, so when you go home tonight, before you go out across the street, are you going to look both ways to see if there's any traffic coming, or are you just going to say, in God I trust, and walk? I didn't ask the question. Another caveat: to trust in God is not the same as saying that no matter what happens, it's God's will. One of my first cousins, just 2 years older than me, died Thursday morning after a short battle with cancer, less than a year. And I have no doubt that he trusted God. I had a conversation with him for 20 minutes just 2 weeks ago, and I heard him express both a desire for healing and a certain level of readiness to accept what might come. And he and all of us prayed for physical healing. I might be in the minority, but I'm not ready to say that God wills death or disease or hunger or disability or abuse or anything that does not represent God's shalom. So long as we are restricted by our humanness, we are subject to negative realities. A third and final clarification: to suggest that trusting God should supersede our reliance on beliefs is not to say that beliefs are meaningless. Just because some people in our society don't understand science does not negate the reality of gravity. Or dare I say it, the scientifically settled reality of climate change. Beliefs are important, they're absolutely important, but they are clearly framed in the context of an individual's place in society, and they are, at their essence, bounded by our finite limits as human beings. And as the Apostle Paul put it so succinctly, we see through a glass darkly. In our day, he might actually say, we look into a cracked mirror. And therefore, what is reflected back to us is distorted. George Neumark, was a 17th century German who lived during the time of the 30 Years' War, when social and economic conditions in Germany were deplorable. He had personal trials as well. On his way to university studies, he was robbed of nearly all of his possessions. And during the next 2 years, he spent much of his time looking for employment. He finally found a tutoring position, and when he had saved enough money, he returned to the university where he studied for 5 years. And then shortly after that, again, he lost all of his belongings in a fire. In the midst of these challenges, he wrote the hymn that we'll now sing together, If Thou But Trust in God to Guide Thee. Amen.